We are gathered again in that dangerous bastion, the church that threatens family values, the church that wants to undermine the authority of the Father, the church that has half forgotten the Creator in its pagan worshiping of the creation. The church that those right-wing radio ministries, I was listening to one this morning, have warned us about. This church of bleeding heart liberalism, some thinly veiled front for leftist politics, of homosexual propaganda. I like it here. The church that assures you you won't be going to hell no matter what you do in this life. And the church that often leaves the first few pews open for the diversity we're sure is going to show up. We're open to it. The church of openly practicing witches whose very assertion they don't believe in any devil confirms they must be accomplishing some of his work. And the church that sings carefully, not sure if there are any words we can totally subscribe to and not be questioning ourselves tomorrow or in the next worship committee meeting. The church that is not sure if there is, in fact, anything we can celebrate with that passion and abandon those other churches hold for Jesus the Savior, Son of God the Father. Although something lurks in us, we might be missing out on some of their fun. It is that search for ecstasy, enlightenment, and other things, including free coffee, which is often the only thing whose origins we don't question, that brings us together. This is my church, and I'm a zealot. This is a church that says to everyone, you're not only welcome, but we need you and your creative input in our continuing, dynamic, and evolving culture. Diversity is a strength, a survival mechanism we believe in. We face the challenge of weighing new and ancient wisdom in our search for guidance in this life, as well as the continuing creation of our own mythology. Yeah. No one cares if somebody hollers in the middle of something politically correct, do you? So we come together in meetings like this to offer each other ourselves for sustenance. And that's about all it says there. I started at the Universalist Church of Norwell, Massachusetts, and because my parents brought me there. And I remember the minister saying, well, that's about all I had to say. But I'm not going to stop now. Yay. something would happen. Something extemporaneous is about to happen. So I just want to paraphrase. I said in there, you won't be going to hell no matter what you do in this life. A little joke. That it's not a joke. The basic tenet of universalism, I remember my dad telling me, I don't know how old I was, 5 or 6, maybe 7, as we left that tall, narrow church, I guess hell had been brought up in the service. Maybe it was in a song, because I know in the old hymn book, the Saved from the Fires of Hell or something like that. And so he said, you know, we universalists, and he had a deep voice, and he was taller than I am, and I had him for math in high school. He said, we universalists don't believe that a loving God would sentence us to an eternity of damnation and hellfire. That was a liberating thing to find out when I was a kid. And that is the gift we give to our young people, to question that bombardment of common accepted knowledge. You know, Dante and the Inferno and everything comes to dominate our whole conception of things. I just thought I'd bring that up. And, you know, I have that pretty well memorized, the thing that I just read. I just hold the piece of paper so you'll know I thought about it ahead of time. It's called the Worcester Islamic Center. I've gone there a number of times. And I was afraid to go, Worcester, Massachusetts. I was afraid to go and afraid I'd do something stupid. My friend Muhammad, that I play tennis with, he said, oh, well, they have chairs over on the side and, you know, for visitors. Well, that picture of what to expect gave me the wherewithal to go. And I tell you that, now that was years ago, but I tell you that so you can feel that you'd be welcome. They have a long talk, and people, 45 minutes of talk, and people come in late and find their space on the rows on the carpet, just like any other church. And then in the last 15 minutes is prayers, and they're usually in Arabic, at least there. So the young imam asked this, how do you love somebody who hates you? How do you love the person who wants to kill you? This was during the first Trump occupation and the Muslim ban and everything. And he went on. So this is the person, I was almost, it was painful to hear a young man another time in a mosque in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And he said, you know, we're not terrorists. This totally American kid. You know, he felt he needed to say that to the visitors who were there. I could go on about that. I won't. So he said, you know, how do you love the person who hates you? And he said, well, let's consider the prophet. And he told these stories of the prophet going out the front door of the building, getting stoned by the crowd so that his friends could escape out the back, because they would have killed his friends while they were afraid to kill him. And the prophet, then going to prayers every day, would walk past a woman selling fruit who would swear at him and spit at him and throw rotten fruit at him. And one day she was not there. And he asked, where's the woman, the fruit seller? And someone said, oh, she's sick. So he went to her and helped her heal. These are well-known stories, you know, and we could probably use stories about Jesus or Gandhi or Martin Luther King or something to make the same point. I knew Pete Seeger for, this is not written here, I just thought of it. I knew Pete Seeger for 40 years. That was half of his performing life, you know. And I find myself saying, well, what would Pete Seeger do? a few days ago on MLK Monday, a couple of weeks ago, I heard MLK's famous speech about loving your enemies in 1957. Now, I'm old enough to have heard that when I was a kid. Maybe it was a replay on television. I remember it just moving me enormously. And I also became aware of Thurgood Marshall and the Brown versus Board of Education, all that. They had very different ways of loving this country. Thurgood Marshall didn't think that much of getting out and protesting and marching and all that. He said, we got to handle this in the legal way. So then in the 60s, you know, Martin Luther King then gives his speech about love and I didn't say it. I'm talking about love because it's Valentine's weekend. We all got that, right? Okay. I'm putting these things that I might talk about in other ways, I'm putting it in a context of love today because of that. Well, he gave a speech about how poor people and people of color are fighting the war over in Vietnam. And along, and he said, with white and black and Hispanic and all, they're over there fighting like brothers, and they come home and they can't live on the same street. This made Martin Luther King unpopular, less popular. It was a real blow to his popularity at that point. And Thurgood Marshall ends up on the Supreme Court, and then Martin Luther King is killed too young. I'm not exactly sure what I'm saying there and what words, that's the end of what I have. What I would say, how does that end up? What are we supposed to do now? Robert Reich writes a blog. He said, the other day, what's keeping us from being more active? What has kept us from being more active? You know, we have this criminal occupant of the White House because I didn't work hard enough. That's what I think. So how do we hold on to love in the face of lies? What I've been saying is, in this war between truth and lies, lies have won for the moment. That's how we got, you know, this in this last election, lies have taken over. Men in suits who lie are nothing new. The level of impunity, though, seems to be shocking. The enemy, if we have one, is division. And we must resist becoming us and them. This is easy to say. Men in suits who lie. I'm old enough to remember anti-communism hysteria of the 50s and Joseph McCarthy, the cigarette companies fighting the truth and buying decades more of sales and killing people. Some of the same lawyers are now fighting the truth of climate change. And now DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, is blamed for causing trouble. Isn't that amazing? Did you ever hear of anything more divisive than inclusion? You let those people in here and that divided us. Wow, there is a school of thought. Did you ever think we'd be up against that? I didn't think people dared to be as racist as that in common practice. So beyond the criminals who tell us lies, a new reality or lack of it, AI and such weapons as ChatGPT are found to be lying. Who would have thought? People are falling in love with their AI voices they hear. NPR told a story yesterday, Saturday, of someone following AI's orders that the love of her life was waiting to meet her somewhere. And she went twice, being misled twice, before confronting her friend, ChatGPT. And the robot did admit it was lying and apologized. Joy Buwalamwini is a professor at Harvard. She started the Algorithmic Justice League to fight against the algorithms of Big Brother, the world of computers, colonizing and enslaving us. Because in their ignorance of privilege, the people who designed and programmed the computers have made them racist. This is going to take some work. I'm going to leave that out. I'm usually preaching to the convicted, you know, so I know you know all of this. But it's just important for me to get up and remind you. The fomenting of misinformation is so easy and so prevalent. How do we stand up against it? I've been speaking about how to deal with a liar lately. I'm going to spare you that. You can Google it. There's 10-point programs and so on. And take it with a grain of salt. But the context I want to put it in today is love. Oh, isn't that cute? Love. Mush. Well, love is a lot more than that. William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign says, love that doesn't care enough to struggle isn't real love. It isn't the full realization of love. So what we need now to keep from being us and them is engagement. I know you don't want to do it. I don't want to do it either. Those people, they don't like me. I don't like them. You know, that crazy uncle or whatever it is, whoever it is, the neighbor, you know. How did we get to the point that we're afraid to talk to them? We're afraid to engage with them. We must. We have 8.5 months. To save one soul, perhaps. Show one soul that a liberal is not the instrument of the devil. And, you know, say, once you interrogate enough or interview enough and have a polite conversation and listen enough to say, I wish we were friends enough that I could tell you, those are lies. You're believing lies. We can't probably deal with the criminals. But the people who believe the lies are not our enemies. It's hard. It's hard for, you know, I don't want to do it. I do it, though, some now, because I'm talking about it. So I boot myself in the butt to, you know, I engaged with a woman the other day as I was returning something to a store. And I usually don't do that. My son, my trans son, who I'm so proud of, who is my best teacher, I say, he said, Dad, you can return that to the store. Okay. I usually just take it, absorb it, you know, and so take it. And the woman is Asian, and her son is in the army, and she voted for Trump. And I said, well, I hope Donald Trump doesn't send him to, you know, to send him to confront citizens in America. She says, oh, yes, I hope not. You know, bad idea, army, you know, everything. And I told her that I was a real environmental extremist and I was doing music for that. She said, oh, yes, the earth. Yes, we need to take care of the earth. And there wasn't a line behind us, so I got to talk to her for a minute. So I said, you know, Donald Trump is not for these things. And that's as far as we got. You know, I thought I better not press it any further. But so you don't win the argument in one session. It's going to take 8 or 10. But if you do one and somebody else does one and you do another, maybe we will save one soul by that November election. I'm told we can endorse candidates from the pulpit now. I'm not going to go that far. But so I mentioned, Robert Reich said, are we not ready to do more to save the world? Those are my words, but he said something like that. I heard an actor playing a diplomat. You probably heard it too, same movie. He said, diplomacy, it doesn't work, it doesn't work, it never works, it doesn't work, until it does. I've been using that line over and over again lately. This is slow work. Can you do it? Will you try it? Will I? Can we? I should say we. So we have a little more than 8 months. I don't have to tell you how important it is. It's going to determine the future of democracy and the survival of the world, if you ask me. So we know what we got to do.